AgriFutures Australia acknowledges the First Nations people of Australia as the traditional custodians of the lands and waters on which we live, learn and work. We pay our respects to past, present and future elders of these nations. AgriFutures head office is located in the lands of the Wiradjuri people of Australia, and we acknowledge them as the traditional custodians of the lands and waters of the region. Hi, and welcome to AgriFutures On Air. I'm Bianca Jiggins, Varroa Coordinator for the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, commonly known as ARBIC, the industry's national peak representative body. In a critical juncture for the honeybee industry, the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, in partnership with AgriFutures, is set to launch a suite of Varroa mite management resources. This suite of resources follows the completion of the Resilient Beekeeping in the Face of Varroa project, an AgriFutures Australia research initiative. This project's been a key focus for the AgriFutures Honeybee and Pollination Program following the incursion of varroa mite in June 2022. More recently, in September 2023, it was announced that the eradication of varroa was no longer technically feasible, leading to a transition to management phase that aims to slow the spread and limit the impacts of varroa mite across Australia's landscape. The Resilient Beekeeping in the Face of Varroa project aims to support the industry through this phase in what is arguably the biggest challenge it has faced. The resources include a set of fact sheets that focus on the key areas of concern, namely biosecurity, treatment, management, breeding, bee health, pollination, and slowing the spread of varroa. The fact sheets will be complemented by a series of interviews, articles, and podcasts to ensure accessibility for beekeepers across various platforms. The resources feature interviews with global experts and concentrate on the lessons Australia can draw from varroa management practices overseas, as well as the potential implementation of these strategies in the Australian beekeeping context. Today, our topic is honeybee health and the impacts of varroa, and we're very lucky to have our special guest, Cameron Jack, from the University of Florida, Associate Professor for Honeybee Health. Welcome, Cameron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I'm super happy to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, so you're the pick of the bunch to have a chat about the health impacts of varroa on honeybees. I know there's other health impacts that will coincide, so we just wanted to kick off with some of your focus in the University of Florida is improving honeybee health. So what can you tell us about what varroa does to honeybees and the general health impacts that we'll experience throughout our colonies in Australia once varroa becomes further spread and endemic?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's important to at least just start with some really basic mite biology. I'm assuming that most, people listening to this are probably somewhat familiar with honeybees biology, but you kind of have to know your enemy. And I mean, to understand varroa, you kind of have to know a little bit about it. So these mites, they are feeding on both hemolymph and fat. They can only reproduce inside of the capped brood cells, the capped honeybee brood cells, right? So while they, that first female that kind of goes down into a honeybee brood cell, what she'll do is like kind of wedge herself down underneath the larva and kind of submerge herself in the brood food. And then once that cell is capped and that larva kind of stands up to start the pupation phase, that's when the mite can kind of start moving around, and then she'll find a location and she'll start feeding. So at that point, she's primarily feeding on some hemolymph, and that hemolymph is the bee's blood, right? And so then she'll start laying an egg, and then about every 30 hours or so, she lays an egg. And that first egg that she hatches will be a male. And then after that, every subsequent egg will hatch and become a female. So you have this male son and the female daughters will mate. And that's the only mating they do kind of throughout their whole time, is in this like short period of time. So they're feeding on the hemolymph while they're in the cells. And then when that adult leaves, now the females that are fully mature will then leave with them. And then they will continue to feed on some adults and get primarily feeding on honeybee fat and to prepare themselves to then continue the process. So you're unlikely to see male varroa because they will stay down in the cells and die. But then, you know, over that 12-day period from the time that the queen, or from the time that a cell is capped for with worker larva to the time that it emerges as a female worker, right? That's 12 days. During that 12-day period, one varroa can come in and then three mites can come out, right? With drones, it's even longer. Or they have like about three extra days, and those 3 days pay big dividends. You have one female goes into a drone cell, then five females come out, right? And so your mite populations can really take off in a hurry, especially in the spring when your bees are making lots of drones. You're going to have lots of mites. And so to get back to your even question, I'm already rambling way more than you even said, Bianca, because you asked me what is the impact. So the impact is, I just wanted to set the stage of their biology a little bit, because their impact really comes down to their numbers. One mite on a bee does very little, right? That's not the problem. It's when you start to have lots of mites inside of a honeybee colony. Now, all of a sudden, your colony is faced with some problems. It introduces a lot of stress. There's lots of physiological stress that, I mean, even without the viruses aside, we'll talk about that in a minute, but just the stress of them feeding on a bee is enough that it affects their immune system. So what happens is, I mean, we already know that there's lots of potential stressors on bees anyways. There's pathogens, there's pesticides, there's all sorts of things, nutritional stresses, right? All these different stresses. And then you just are layering on another level of stress. And as probably a lot of the listeners already know too, is just that you know, when you couple varroa with viruses particularly, that's usually the recipe for the biggest disaster. Because what these mites are doing, since they're going from bee to bee to bee and feeding as adults, there are some viruses that they can transmit, or most of them they can transmit, which means they're spreading it from bee to bee. But there are some that they can vector, which is kind of a difference. Important to point out that not all viruses they vector, but some of them they do. And what that means is that when they pick up a virus, it replicates inside their salivary glands, and then they're injecting a lot of virus into bees. And so a famous example, obviously, for a lot of the world is deformed wing virus, which we'll talk about that probably here in greater detail. But that's when usually, like at least for us in the States, where we have just seen the coupling of varroa with deformed wing virus has really been the greatest recipe of troubles that we've had. So it doesn't mean that without the presence of deformed wing virus, that varroa is not a problem. It does introduce a level of stress that can be really problematic when your bees are already stressed.
Yeah, so, that ripple effect of all those other parts. Yeah, so they forage at a younger age. They have a decreased flight performance. So that's going to impact then on the health, right? They're not going to forage far enough, or they're foraging too soon. They're not carrying enough.
When bees are really stressed, they often don't share food, which is a problem when you're thinking of the colony dynamics of bees that require a lot of food sharing. Yeah. Right?
It's just so complex in terms of a disruption to an existing colony. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great starting point to move into.
Way more than you asked.
no, not really. It is important. It's important to see that just the nature of the relationship between the two and the parasite. We have to remember that's what it is, and so it does have those other flow-on effects. So I guess what'd be great to understand is just some of those impacts as a colony. Like the body weight issues, the change to hypopharyngeal glands. Do you think that obviously the different levels of varroa at different times of the year, that it's easy to pick up on some of those things and to see them appearing in colonies when you're doing an inspection or a maintenance of your hives? And what should people be looking for things? Can you point to some tips about what's predominantly referred to as a varroa issue versus what we currently have in Australia, which might be what seems now is very simple AFB or EFB or some other existing issue that we've got. So what are some really pointy things that we should notice about parasitic mite syndrome, for example, that would be really prominent for us to see or look for in particular?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had already mentioned deforming virus in the sense that, like, that is what I'm telling most of the beekeepers in probably most of the world, that I'm telling them, you know, look at this. If you are seeing lots of bees with deformed wings, or if you're seeing bees, there are other viruses that are transmitted and vectored by varroa. And a lot of viruses kind of turn bees dark, hairless, kind of have a greasy complexion. Like, if you see that, I mean, that is still something even in Australia that you could be looking for. If you see those, you know, bees that tend to have some viruses, even if it's not deformed wings, then that still means your colony is being really negatively impacted. But then, as you already mentioned, Bianca, there's some of these other kind of maybe what I'd say maybe is slightly lower tier impacts, but things that you could be looking for. You know, with the parasitic mite syndrome, right? Like, I mean, that is kind of a real general term for just the colony struggling, and kind of what you tend to see is bees that are brood patterns that look particularly spotty. They just don't look good, and you just have colonies that are getting smaller. They're just not, you know, they're not. You'll notice it when, I mean, we see this, and you see every beekeeper sees this. You have one colony, right? Like two colonies on a hive stand. One of them looks great. One of them looks really bad. You know that they have access to the same thing. You've treated them essentially the same way. Why is one doing better than the other? Probably in a lot of cases, it has to do with varroa. I mean, varroa levels get high.
Yeah.
These colonies just start getting weak. Again, it kind of comes back down to stress levels. I mean, they've got...
It's cumulative.
Cumulative stress. I mean, there's so many variables in beekeeping and so many environmental impacts that when you add something like this, like varroa, it can be particularly rough. So at this point, you know, without the addition of deformed wing virus, right? I mean, I would primarily be telling a lot of Australian beekeepers, I mean, some of the signs that you might notice as like your first clue would be a really spotty brood pattern, which can mean a lot of different things. I realize that, and then just kind of a dwindling population. But even still, I mean, I hate to say it that way because that already means it's at a serious problem. Just looking straight on a frame and looking for mites, which is what a lot of the world tries to do, and it just doesn't work.
We're trying to incentivize monitoring with alcohol washing, which when varroa is at a certain levels, it's definitely a good detection method and a good addition to a beekeeper's practice. What can you say about sort of the prevalence of viruses and the impacts, and then that managing varroa levels by beekeepers, and how important is it to understand what the varroa levels are and treat them accordingly to get the balance of the health of the colony as best as you possibly could be having for a beekeeper?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, those viral levels, you know, they will kind of naturally increase, decrease kind of throughout the season. I mean, there are always some low levels of viruses present in honeybee colonies. That's just the reality of jamming, you know, 20,000 individuals together in a tight space. Like, there's going to be viruses. But then having something like varroa that can move them, it really elevates it to a level that's just not sustainable. And so it just comes, you know, it comes down to not being able to, when it gets out of balance. So particularly, I didn't say this earlier, but if we were thinking of varroa biology, and I had already said that the mites can only reproduce inside honeybee brood cells. So what will happen is as your honeybees are increasing in the spring, guess what? The mites are also increasing in the spring. When your bees are, you know, kind of reaching that peak population in the summer, your mites are also growing still. And this is when it really becomes a problem, is when your bees are starting to come down in the fall and your queens are slowing down and there's not as much brood rearing happening, there's still enough brood for varroa to keep growing. So particularly in autumn, right, that's when you're going to have the greatest separation, or just the high mites per bee. And that's when those virus issues really tend to start manifesting.
The pointy end of the impacts, yeah.
Yes.
That's really important. So I guess when this recording is provided to Australian beekeepers, we're expecting it to be March, which will be heading into our winter eventually, not a few months away. So that's a good time to be able to pick up levels of varroa with the decline in population of bees going on. I just wanted to touch on a little bit, just back a few steps, where you mentioned two hives at an apiary, or any number of hives at an apiary, and one hive looking really healthy and another hive looking, from the outside, looking pretty awful. Is it an indication, just by looking at a healthy hive, that they may not have any varroa? From my experience, seeing colonies in the eradication phase of the response was really interesting to say, well, hang on, that hive looked like it was half dead. It didn't have as much varroa as the healthy colony. Can we just demystify that?
Yeah, that's great. And I'm so glad you're asking me to clarify, because I certainly don't want to give the impression that, like, if your bees look healthy, that means they probably don't have mites, because that's not true at all. There, as I kind of said before, there are so many factors that are playing into this. You know, we see this all the time, that you can have a big, strong colony with lots of mites, because a big, strong colony is producing lots of brood, right? And if you've got lots of brood, there's more opportunities for varroa to keep reproducing. And so even sometimes you have a big, strong colony and you might sample it and it might have fewer mites than one over here, the colony that's struggling and is kind of even queenless, you know, but that has to do with varroa dynamics, right? Like, if there's little brood, then where are all the mites? They're on the bodies of the adults, right? So you see them and you're like, holy smokes, this is really bad. Oh, but good, this one's over here. But even reality, they might have the same number of mites, just the big strong one, they're more hidden because they're down inside the brood cells. But
and that robbing, you know, behavior that would be happening ultimately is the demise of that spread opportunity. Like, it proliferates that opportunity to spread because of the health.
But healthier. Then as soon as that, like, let's say that wheat colony goes, that wheat colony goes, and now there's still all those mites are going to go somewhere, because they're going to be latching on to bees as much as they can. And then they're going to make their way into the colonies nearby. And so it's just kind of
honeybee characteristics really are their own, their own worst enemy, unfortunately.
Spread really rapidly. And it can be, if you've got a big, strong colony, that's actually when you really do want to keep, I mean, you shouldn't stop looking for varroa there, because, it's possible that they're just brooding up, because then once they still hit that threshold, I mean, they're strong right now, but in a few weeks down the road, after the varroa have had a little bit of time, they're going to come back down. You know, there is a limit to how many mites that your colony has a carrying capacity to be able to handle this. Now, with the absence of deformed wing virus, your carrying capacity might be higher. But that doesn't mean that there's not a threshold, there's not a limit.
There's a limit because somewhere in there.
There is a limit somewhere, and you're going to find it if you don't bring it
and
down.
And that'll probably depend on people's location and the lack or the presence of a brood break naturally in our environment for different. We have so many multiple different climate conditions in Australia for that. But Yeah. So can you talk about that increased colony susceptibility to disease with varroa? Like, are they going to be more likely to attract, I guess, varroa if they're already unwell? So good beekeeping is ultimately the best prevention for losses of varroa? Or are they, is the susceptibility thing just not really there? It's just the natural behavior of honeybees that will give them a yes or a no to whether they're going to end up with large levels of varroa.
Yeah, well, a lot of it has to do, I guess, with two things. I mean, the biology of the honeybee, like we already said, if they're robin, you know, they're more likely to either be, it can really flow both ways. If you've got a weak colony that is struggling with varroa and they're getting robbed, and then there's possibility that those mites are going to leave the weak colony and then be spreading out, right? Like as those bees are getting in. But then there's also it could be the opposite. You've got a weak colony that's getting robbed that doesn't have varroa, but then you have all these bees coming in that have mites, you know, it could just finish them off.
The stress factor for that colony and the slow demise of that sort of situation.
Yeah.
One of your topics of expertise is Nosema and varroa. If we are going to be thinking about reviewing this or seeing this in this sort of autumn time in Australia, what can you tell us about the connection between the two?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, what's funny is obviously I didn't really mean for this to happen in terms of like I kind of get pegged as either the Nosema guy or the varroa guy. And it's like, during my master's, I studied Nosema. Right. I was at Oregon State University in the Pacific Northwest in the United States. And I studied for 2 years. I had done all this Nosema research, and then I'd go be sharing that research to beekeepers throughout California and Oregon and Washington. And then, you know, at the end, a bunch of hands would go up and then they would all just ask me about varroa. And I was just like, well, why am I studying Nosema? I should be studying varroa. So that's why I went to Florida. To work with Dr. Jamie Ellis at the time. It's been about almost a decade ago now. And so I've been studying varroa for almost 10 years. But it's good because I've had that background with Nosema. And as you kind of mentioned, you know, there has been some literature out there that shows how the two can play off each other. But really, I think what it comes down to, again, and I already said this, is it's stress, right? I mean, Nosema doesn't necessarily mean it's going to finish off your colony. Varroa doesn't necessarily mean it's going to finish off your colony. But there are two underlying stressors that you put them together and your bees are just in rough shape. Nosema really affects them nutritionally. It kind of forces the bees to eat more and they also just produce less. That kind of makes them start to dwindle. Varroa will cause them to, you know, just not behave the right, you know, the way that they should. They are also just physiologically usually weaker because they're just being damaged, or, you know, in our case for sure, viruses are the primary reason for that. But there's you just kind of put these stressors upon on each other, and you really kind of have a recipe for for disaster. I mean, because again, that doesn't mean there won't be nutritional stress in your area. You know, that doesn't mean that there's not going to be pesticide exposure to agrochemicals that otherwise, you know, would be a really low risk to bees. But then just kind of with the mixture of things, it just kind of starts to compound and it becomes an issue. So
what are some good methods to prevent Nosema? And if that's going to be, you know, I guess, as you say, it's not the single thing that will terminate a colony, but what are some methods that beekeepers can do just to prevent that particular issue in general?
Yeah. Well, what's funny is, so I was doing some research, I told you, for my master's, focusing specifically on Nosema. And as part of that research, we looked at different antibiotics. We looked at different like feeding supplements. We looked at like multiple things, and really we never really saw anything that was significantly better than doing nothing. I mean, okay. Really, what the best thing that we saw?
Site selection.
Well, maybe? So site selection will play a big role, because the thing that seemed to have the biggest impact was just the nutritional, like abundance, like having
that environment. You know,
having a good environment where they could eat, and like having access to good nutrition seemed to do more. Actually, what's really interesting, and I think there's still a lot of people focusing on this, but you know, when you have good nutritionally, or bees that have good nutrition, they actually have more Nosema than bees that are malnourished. If you think about it, it's like Nosema is a pathogen that's an obligate gut parasite. If the host is malnourished, then there's nothing for them to, there's no nutrients for that to replicate. So I kind of am not a huge fan of thinking of Nosema in the sense of like counting spores and thinking like, wow, this colony's got a lot, like a higher intensity. I think the more appropriate approach would be to think of it as like, how common is it, or how prevalent is it? Like if I sampled 10 bees and looked at them individually and I found it in 5 of the 10, now that's probably a problem. I mean, it's like probably like about 50% of my bees are infected, which means they're probably not doing particularly well. So my best advice when I'm talking to beekeepers is I don't worry so much about the treatment of Nosema. I just want to make sure that my bees have access to good resources. When they're hungry, I feed them. When there's, you know, that's basically what it comes down to, is I doing something like that can really, having good nutrition can really go a long way. I think there's still a lot to unpack about like pollen patties and things like that, where we've got some data that kind of shows like, it's not particularly effective. And actually, when I say we, that was the royal we. I didn't really do much of that research. There's a researcher, but from our lab, Emily Nordyke, who's actually now in Australia, New South Wales. But she did a lot of this research.
Thanks for sharing, Emily.
Emily's so great. And I hope she watches this. So she knows that. I think she's really great.
She's involved in this. So she'll be in another one focusing on pollination industry and impacts. So
good.
She's a good egg.
She's great.
That nutrition impact is just can't be ignored, can't be put aside. Important and so critical. Running a healthy enterprise of any kind, whether it's other types of livestock, honeybees are absolutely no different.
And I was gonna say, I don't, so important. We know a bit more of it on this Nosema side, and because I feel like it's a little bit easier for us to study that than it is to study Varroa. But there's absolutely nutritional impacts on like for Varroa as well. When you have nutritionally stressed bees and then you add Varroa, you also have a problem, right? I mean, there's just a higher likelihood of infection and things like that can play. So, I mean, a take home message for a lot of beekeepers is make sure your bees have access to good. it plays an important role.
Yeah, absolutely. We have touched on deform wing a little bit. We have other viruses in Australia that we know of. At the moment, currently, we've got enough studies to say that deform wing is not present, which is a good thing. And I know a lot of other countries, like New Zealand, for example, didn't have deform wing immediately when they first started living with Varroa. So we're hopeful that we can keep deform wing out for as long as possible. There are viruses that we do have that are, as I understand, have an association with Varroa. Israeli acute bee paralysis virus and Kashmir bee virus. Can you tell us a bit about them? Do we need to worry really badly about them?
So this is going to just sound like I'm a broken record, Bianca, and I'm sorry.
We're going to say compounding.
I was just going to say, also Israeli acute paralysis virus, Kashmir bee virus, those two are actually indistinguishable in terms of just like looking for colony level impact. Like the only way you'd really be able to differentiate between the two is through like molecular diagnostics, right? I mean, because essentially they do very similar things. And And they, I don't know that on their own, again, they're not really a big deal. But then
that's great
you
to
just,
know.
You like, couple
I'm hope,
them.
I was hoping that was going to be your answer.
Yeah.
We
yeah,
don't
I
want
mean,
another big issue
we
coming
find,
along.
We find Israeli acute paralysis virus a lot when it's coupled with Nosema infection. We find it a lot when it with like when you have high varroa loads. Some of these things tend to show up and be at higher levels when they are already stressed. But I mean, they're not deformed wing virus, I'll say that. Where like deformed wing virus is so crippling and such a terrible virus. But those are two viruses that now add stress. So you've got varroa that adds stress. You've got viruses that add stress. Higher varroa, higher viruses, more stress. So it's that's why I was saying I sound like a broken record, because it's just all about bees get stressed. You keep adding these layers. And you know, the fact that you don't have deformed wing virus right now is wonderful. I just would really caution beekeepers listening to, you do not want to get complacent about like managing varroa or thinking like this is not a problem, because viruses change, viruses show up, and if it does show up and you already have lots of varroa spread wide through, then all of a sudden you're gonna feel it very, very quickly. It will spread. And with high varroa populations, it's going to spread very quickly and become a problem. That's why it's just, in my opinion, which maybe doesn't count for a whole lot in this point, but in my opinion, you know, you should be more scared of deformed wing virus than varroa. But you've got varroa now, so now you do need to be extra worried about that, which means you need to be working to manage your mites appropriately to get them to a level where they're not out of control, or else it could spell problems very quickly if deformed wing virus shows up.
Yeah, so at the moment, varroa is our closest crocodile to the boat.
Yeah.
Is that what you say?
Yes.
And
that's a really good way to put it. Yes.
What can you tell us about the things that people doing in honeybees in America in general of reducing that deforming virus load? What's the biggest tick item? And it goes to say, even if we don't have it, that the same method is important for just having varroa in general as well here in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, that's important to note that, you know, there's really not much, if anything, we can do for deformed wing virus. Like, we can't put in something, at least at the moment, and remove deforming virus, right? What we can do is remove the vector that causes deforming virus to really elevate, which is varroa. So that's our strategy. I mean, when deforming virus is really our issue, but we can't attack that, so we need to attack what is supporting that, and that's controlling varroa. So what beekeepers are primarily doing in the United States, I'm going to put as a poor example of what I think should be done in the sense that like,
okay, good. Yep.
Well, you know, varroa have been in the United States since 1987. It spread very rapidly from the time that it was first found. It was found in North Carolina. So it's on kind of the East Coast of the United States, kind of mid-East Coast, but from the time that they found it to the time that it spread throughout the United States was very quickly. I mean, and that has a lot to do, obviously, with commercial pollination and trucking bees around and moving. But then, of course, it has a lot to do with beekeepers moving, you know, frames of bees, moving them around and not, and I think taking
practice
very lightly the fact that I think when it hit us, we were not monitoring carefully. We only had one treatment option really available that people were using widespread. They were just using Apistan. everybody's using the same thing. Everybody kind of lightly was just like, well, this is going to be a problem, but I put this strip in here and now it takes care of it. And they weren't really looking to see how well things were doing. And so very quickly, about 1995 or so is when there started being lots of reports. So, I mean, that's 7 years later, like basically very widespread resistance to the active ingredient of that product, fluvalinate. And then beekeepers are now, there's not a lot there, right? There's not a lot of other options. So people moved on to the next chemical. The active, or the trade name was called Checkmite Plus, right? And this is, the active ingredient is Kumafos. Everybody's using it. Goes away very quickly, within about like 2 years even, like very quickly. People found that just, wow, this like resistance went really, really fast. And then we've kind of been the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, I guess we've been using Ametraz very heavily as an industry. And I think we've gotten away with it for a very long time, but we're starting to get our comeuppance, right? Like there's starting to be widespread resistance. And there's becoming more and more issues, beekeepers just having to treat all the time, but they're still kind of just using the same product. A lot of commercial beekeepers are only using Ametraz. They're just treating, you know, 8 times a year, which is crazy. I mean, so expensive and also just hard on your bees and your bee health and your wallet as a beekeeper. So these are
all of those things.
Yeah. So, but this is, you know, where I can kind of preach this until I'm blue in the face. And it's hard to do this when your livelihood depends on it, but you have to get into this mindset to, you're going to run on that same treadmill that we've been on. If there's not an understanding generally from beekeepers that monitoring is important. You need to know if you have the mite or not. You need to understand what level of mites you have. And then you choose an appropriate treatment for your situation. And you should be choosing different. There are multiple options. And a beekeeper from Australia just last night shared with me a really nice table of some different treatments that are, you know, either being approved or have been approved. So there are some different things you have to have a mindset of being willing to rotate, and you're managing a mite, not trying to eradicate a mite anymore, right? That's like, right. So this is the difference.
It's a fight you can't win if you're trying to get rid of every single one of them.
Right.
And it's again, a balance, right? Of intervening, keeping the mite loads down and to a level where bees can still keep going. And we've had this misconception, I think, of, well, the whole world manages Varroa, we can do it too. And that's great, because Australians are really vivacious people and they've got some resilience about them and they're keen for challenges. But in terms of like managing mites, it's not that simple. It's not just, oh, everybody else is doing it, we can do it too, in a way. It's about really understanding that intricate relationship between the environment in Australia that's going to be different everywhere, the mite load, what each enterprise or beekeeper is wanting out of their colonies, and then intervening to keep mites down can also impact honeybee health because of the choice of chemical or the adoption of whatever that intervention is, right? So can you tell us a little bit about bee health in terms of what impacts we've created in keeping bees alive using different methods to treat?
Right. Yeah, that's really well said. I mean, there's, if I'm thinking about different methods, some of you might picture this because maybe you've seen this at this point. You know, we've got that integrated pest management pyramid, like control pyramid. You've got this, just imagine a pyramid. And as you move up, you're kind of increasing the potential risk to the environment, to the colonies, right? And so kind of that low level is actually prevention. And so then some of, you know, I say that in the United States and they're just like, well, Cameron, that ship has sailed, right? Like, how can we prevent? But actually you can do something, right? I mean, prevention can be, as in my opinion, is as simple as swarm prevention, you know, managing your bees. Right. Well, if you're letting swarms go off all the time, you're just putting reservoir colonies where more mites can be in your area, and you're going to keep getting reinfested no matter what. So actually preventing a larger problem, to me, it looks like something like swarm prevention. But then you kind of move up that, well, and prevention for, you know, for you is still very different. Like, you know, other places, like, let's just take like Queensland, for instance, right? I mean, they still have probably a larger desire to be preventing, right? Like prevention. You all know this so much better than I do.
Keep it away as long as possible.
Do what you can.
That's where we're trying to slow the spread, so that impact is slower across the landscape. But
because once it happens, that's a different prevention. There's no going back. Yeah, you just can't. Yeah. You're not going to rid it out at this point. So do your best to prevent. That's great. Okay, let's just say, like, now you've got it. You're going to have to do something. Then kind of that next level is like a cultural control, where you're changing the environment to make it less suitable for the pest. So there are a couple of options here, right? There's one of them is using hygienic stock. So, you know, people have been breeding bees for decades to have stock that are kind of good at managing low populations. They do things that disrupt the mite behavior and reproduction, such as uncapping and removing infested brood and things like that. You know, those come with costs too, because now you're focusing on a specific trait, and so you might be sacrificing some other traits. But that's one method that can potentially have an effect. Another example of a culture control where you're changing the environment could be something like forcing a brood break. This is something that is, I would say, is more popular in Europe, with a lot of European beekeepers that I've talked to. I think some more Americans are doing this, but it comes at a significant cost to the beekeeper. But basically, forcing a brood break means that you're caging the queen and forcing a stop in reproduction. And we already talked about it, right? The mites can only reproduce down inside the brood cell. So if there's no brood, then where are all the mites? Then they're on the bodies of the adults, right? So then you can come in, the idea is you come in with one fell swoop, treat with something, you knock down a lot of mites. It can, coupled together, it can be, you know, decently effective, but then that comes at a significant cost to. Yeah, exactly. Wrong time of year, you're going to be in trouble. I mean, I even saw that when we tried to couple a chemical with brood break, and I was doing this in kind of our very early autumn. I mean, where we were in Florida, just it's still crazy hot outside. I feel like it was still summer, but it was still too late, because most of those colonies that I caged the queen, they didn't recover. I mean, the queen survived. I was caging them for 24 days to make sure there was nothing, not even any drone brood possibly left, nowhere for those mites to hide. And the queen survived. I could release them. But then those colonies just didn't have time to build back up, and they just ended up not doing well. So that kind of a treatment comes particularly at a cost.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard someone say that here, very recently, just in conversation, a beekeeper saying, oh, I'm going to cage my queen. And I kind of thought, when we're talking about existing stress on honeybee colonies, I kind of thought, if you didn't have Varroa, would you ever do that to your colony? And if we're not practiced at this particular method, you're taking a pretty big risk of trying to get it right. There's probably a really small window of opportunity to get it really right. And I've also read that there are issues sometimes with queens being reintroduced after that time, that they're not successful as well, which, you know, that's just anecdotal. But that's one method.
That
does have a health impact, right? And it might be a non-chemical method, which is great. There's got to be more of those. We've also got drone brood methods of removal, which is, you know, we're using that in Australia at the moment as an option. It does obviously take some planning on the beekeeper's behalf to be able to, you know, do all of those parts at the right time.
Good luck too. but
yeah,
so planning is important.
We don't get really good. yep, that's right. Yeah, and I think there are benefits and things to all different types, but I guess that that susceptibility of the honeybee as well. There's a real balance again between the chemicals we're using, that whether they are organic or synthetic chemicals, in terms of managing in a chemical way. There are really distinct levels of all the types of options that are this much, you know, toxic to the varroa, but they're also closely toxic to bees at certain, you know, some chemicals are very closely toxic to bees, right? And so I'm thinking about the use of some of the organic chemicals. We have got some on the way that, and everybody's, you know, wanting to be able to use oxalic. And, you know, I've heard some horror stories about oxalic from all different countries, especially when I visited New Zealand and seen varroa there and treatments that they're doing and the methods in which they're applying it. But oxalic and things like formic can really, you know, you can do it wrong, can't you? And you can affect that colony. So a bit like the risk you take when you might introduce drone trapping as an option, or you might introduce queen trapping as an option. All of the options have those pros and cons.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Have you seen sort of a fail? Can you give us an example of like a failed, you know, good-willed intention, but a failure that stands out in the time you've been beekeeping?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can think of probably dozens of examples. I mean, you know, for instance, formic acid, you had mentioned that both formic acid based treatments like Formic Pro and Mitoway Quick Strips, and then you've got like other like compounds that are really volatile, like thymol based treatments, like such as like Apigard and things. Both of those are chemical treatments that actually can be used effectively and can be really great if they're used under their proper conditions, and you would have to follow the label in those cases and make sure you're doing it right, because that's a product that could really hurt your bees if it's used inappropriately. But it can work well. I mean, we've seen it. I mean, Florida, our climate, I would say, is probably closer to kind of northern Australia, like in Queensland, where it's going to be decently hot and fairly humid, you know, near the coast. But you put something like formic acid in the middle of the summer, and your bees are going to just leave, or they're going to leave behind. Your brood is just going to be melted. Like, they're just, it's
scary.
It's just really, it can be really rough. But, you know, we have found, even when it's, of course, it gets very, very hot here, but as long as we can time it right in certain, like for us, you know, that's like winter. If we can hit it at the right time, it can be really good. But I've definitely seen people make those mistakes. I haven't necessarily seen major issues with varroa, but I have seen with oxalic acid. I haven't seen like major problems with that, but I've had more people injure themselves with oxalic acid than they have like necessarily injuring their bees.
I mean, great.
It's one of those things that like, and I actually use oxalic acid pretty regularly, and I've done quite a bit of research with that. And I think it's a tool that can be used well, but just like any tool, I mean, I can still take a hammer and it's great for smashing nails in, but if I use it wrong and I smash my thumb, it's going to hurt really bad, right?
That's right.
And so with oxalic acid is just another example. Just because a chemical is natural doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. You concentrate anything and a lot of things can be really terrible. So oxalic acid concentrated can be really tough on your skin and your eyes and your, if you breathe
airway.
It in, if you're vaporizing it, yeah, it can cause lots of problems. So it's just one of those things that now that Australia has Varroa. It's not everywhere, but it's now that it's there, it's adding a layer of complication that you didn't have before. And so I was kind of talking earlier about how Varroa are stressed and all these layers of stress. Well, beekeepers are stressed too. And I totally, you know, I understand that this is now another layer of stress that you will be more stressed than you were before, but you have to, I mean, you have to do something or else it's going to be going to continue to be even a bigger problem. So
yeah, we can't put our heads in the sand about
it. You can't put your heads in the sand. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that this is what these particular interviews are really pointing at for beekeepers, is just to get some really good information and I guess have a practice of some different treatment options and to make sure that, you know, we don't give up, but we acquire as much information and utilize it to our needs. So as you said, differences in temperature or similarities in the temperature for where you are to northern parts of Australia in Queensland. So some chemicals that are that organic option for Mitaway Quick Strips is available as it's permitted for use in Australia at the moment. There will be other parts of the country that will pretty much be able to use that. We've got some like high altitude areas where beekeepers go and different areas of, you know, west of our Great Divide that do experience cooler weather that's a bit more predictable. And so it's about understanding, I guess, the range of options and the tools in the belt and picking up which ones work and which ones might not. Just in terms of what works, what doesn't work, and learning from each other and things, what can you tell us? It's a bit of a jump from what we've just been talking about, but what can you tell us about beekeepers in the US participating in surveys? So we're thinking that we might be able to utilize a coal loss survey in Australia. Because we haven't had Varroa, we've probably not been as incentivized to use something like that. Can you give us a bit of info about what it would be like for us to use that sort of survey and what people can do with the data? Because we don't really do it here. We keep our records and we do those things, but we don't have like this one place where that's collected. And I think it can play into treatment effectiveness and what someone's doing, what this area is doing and what's working. So can you give us a plug for joining up to a survey or utilizing that to understand more about your business or your beekeeping and the health of your colonies?
Well, that's a really important point, Bianca, because I feel like sometimes we just need something to shake us a little bit and really wake us up. And I think Varroa has kind of universally done that. I've kind of just say, hey, beekeepers, like now it's time for you to pay attention and kind of work. Like you're going to have to work collectively. Surveys are a really powerful way to work collectively because they represent so much data. And now we're in the point of like technology where those tools to be able to mine these data, right, and really figure out, dig deep in like what we are seeing in trends and what people are doing and what's effective and what's not. I mean, that can play a major role on decisions. You know, it's kind of like, you know, just saying when people are complaining about their government, but they don't vote. I know that's not the same for Australia because,
we have to vote.
You have to vote.
But people still get away with not voting. But right, understand. I understand the concept. So, you've got to be a part of it too.
You just got to be part of it. If you got to have that like point, and it's kind of the same thing as like, you've got to be able to put your information and allow that to be part of like the collective understanding so that better decisions can be made.
Drives decision making.
Yeah, and it just, and what it really does, Bianca, probably the most important thing is it drives funding. I have like as a researcher from a research perspective, if I apply for a grant and I want to do something, but I have no preliminary data or no information to really back it up, I'm not going to get that grant. I have to come with some data, but surveys are such a good way to to present data and say, we've got this many beekeepers, we've got this many beekeepers reporting that they have varroa in these locations. We have this many beekeepers reporting losses because of these different stressors. All of a sudden, you can capture the world's attention. I think, you know, beekeepers, we kind of put ourselves in a box because we really like to interact. I say this as lovingly as possible, keeping in mind that, like, I grew up in a beekeeping family and consider myself a beekeeper as well, right? Is that, you know, we kind of put ourselves in this box where we like to interact with other beekeepers. But you have to remember, the vast majority of people don't care. It's not even necessarily that they don't care, but they don't know enough to care. There's too many other issues. Yeah, about beekeeping and honeybees. Okay. Like
the general population
has got a lot of other problems. Like us. So you come to them and you're like, hey, this is a problem. We've got this mite. They're gonna be like, yeah, that's true, but we've got this other problem, right? That's gonna capture the attention. But if you can come to them and say, hey, we've got this problem, look at these numbers, this is out of control. That's so much more powerful in getting attention and getting funding to be able to solve some of these problems. So I think it's huge to start getting, you know, hopefully helping to convince beekeepers that it's worth your while. I know we all kind of feel survey fatigue. Get so many emails a day asking for your feedback and blah, blah, blah. Like, that kind of drives you nuts, but this is worth it. This is one of those areas that in terms of collecting beekeeping
community.
Yes, do it, because it can really help. And so many, it helps with research, it helps with government, you know, funding and participation, it helps with management, decision making. And even, you know, if it's produced in such a way where those data become available to you as a beekeeper, you can go mine your own data, like, right? Like, you can go look and see, like, hey, these are the trends that they're saying that seem to work when they have these levels of mites or something, and they're using these types of products. Now we're having better results. It's informative for you as well, not just for researchers doing who knows what. It's important for you as a beekeeper.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's great. I think that's a fair kind of bit of info about the benefits. I really I can see that in Australia we do that in other agriculture. There's lots of data that's provided, and I don't think that the honeybee industry here is as incentivized as other industries, but I think we've really got to come to terms with the validity of that data being put together from beekeepers themselves, and then that utilization for us. We can do it too, like, we can benefit and we can look at those trends and make decisions. Historically we've all used data at some point to provide future funding for the industry. And beekeepers in Australia would be familiar with the data that we use for our honey production, you know, to protect our forest access example. So yeah, there's lots of reasons why it would work now in terms of health for bees and managing varroa. It's almost the end. I'm sad to say. I just want one more question about what you kind of, you know, you've been dealing with varroa for quite some time. We're going to go through this process as an industry. We're going to face a lot of challenges. What's your best advice for us to, you know, as we're adapting through all this stuff with varroa, what's your best advice for us to stay on track as an industry in Australia?
So this is, you know, I've kind of said this earlier, is you have the opportunity to learn from everybody else's mistakes. I mean, being the last means that you now can look at what has become of everybody else, right? And what you see, I'm going to put this in the, at least in the U.S. perspective, because that's what I know the best. If you're looking at the U.S. in our state of apiculture, we are constantly in a state of panic. Because when we are struggling to keep control of this mite, which is by far our biggest problem, and we continually run short of options that are effective and part of that problem. I mean, really, we've created this mess for ourselves in the sense that, you know, we were very lackadaisical about not letting the mite spread across our entire country very quickly. We were, you know, very lackadaisical related to choosing a treatment. We just chose like one chemical treatment, one synthetic chemical, and just basically everybody used those until they stopped working. And now we just dug ourselves into this hole where we're in trouble. And it takes a lot to actually bring a new product to market. And a lot of companies don't necessarily want to produce lots of chemicals because beekeepers either are accessing the active ingredient illegally and doing it themselves, which de-incentivizes a company from wanting to do this, but also beekeeping as a giant is not a giant agricultural industry. It's a very niche industry. And so they might feel like they're not going to get a return on investment. So anyways, if you as a Australian beekeeper are looking at what is kind of the state of others, it should hopefully give you enough of a sense that you don't want this. And you already mentioned Australians are just resilient. They're up for a challenge, but you don't necessarily have to have this challenge. You can put that focus somewhere else as long as you could keep Varroa out of your area, or if it's in your area, then now you manage it in an intelligent way versus just doing one thing over and over and over and over and over until you lose it. So that would probably be my best advice I could give everybody would be to look at the nature of what the mistakes of the past or mistakes of that others have made, learn from it. And you can primarily do that by monitoring and treating and rotating your treatments, right? So doing something active, the days of being able to just kind of like put your bees out, come back and remove them after they've been on spotted gum for a few weeks and just loving that, like that doesn't exist anymore. You've got to be doing something actively against your mites or it's going to create problems that you've just not faced before.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you. That's a fantastic point. And you're right, like it's time to really pull our socks up. And do our best, keep our bees going and keep this wonderful industry that we all love working in going. Yeah. Oh, well, that's great. Well, look, thank you. It's been really lovely to chat with you. You've been extremely valuable to the process of us learning more about managing Varroa and being resilient through this new phase. Thank you, Cameron Jack, for joining us. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bianca. I hope to come back in person again sometime and go visit and truly, I mean, I told you earlier that I started focusing my research on Varroa because I wanted to help beekeepers. And, you know, if there are ways that I can assist you and right now, and Abik in general, and I mean, I'm more than happy to do that. I think this is, I feel very passionate about this. Obviously this, I feel passionate about our bees, but I feel passionate about beekeepers too. And I know what this means for you, for the industry and for beekeepers personally. And it is a serious issue. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk and just know, again, I'm happy to help as much as I can.
Thank you. You're amazing. You're a huge asset to any level of industry. So thanks so much. You've been listening to AgriFutures On Air, a podcast brought to you by AgriFutures Australia. I'm Bianca Jiggins, Varroa Coordinator for the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, and I've been speaking with Dr. Cameron Jack, Associate Professor for Honeybee Health at the University of Florida. Today's topic was bee health in the face of Varroa. Stay tuned for more episodes in this series that will contribute towards minimising the impacts of Varroa in beekeeping in Australia. For full access to a huge backlog of stories on Australia's agricultural trends, innovations, research outcomes, inspiring stories from our rural leaders, and insights into new and emerging rural industries, please subscribe to AgriFutures On Air, on your favourite podcasting app. You can also find more information at the AgriFutures website, www.agrifutures.com.au.